Okay, thanks. Thanks again. Thanks for coming back. So this is the second session in this afternoon of discussion. First of all, we're going to listen to a talk by Mark Fisher, who unfortunately, due to circumstances beyond his control, could not make it this afternoon. But he has sent a brief presentation, which is called Capitalism is More Real Than You Are. And then after that, Alexei Kukulievic, who's a philosopher and practicing artist, will also give a brief presentation. And then Alexei and I will talk for a little while, and then once again, you know, we'll reserve the last half hour, say from 5:30 till 6, we'll open it up to a broader discussion. So I think if we can start with Mark's presentation.
Okay, the title of my presentation today is Capital is More Real, Prolegomena to an Eliminativist Marxism. It's a necessarily complete and provocative series of remarks. Intended as a kind of introduction to a project which will explore the connections between certain kinds of eliminativist philosophy and Marxism. And it's driven by the conviction that there are productive, fruitful connections to be drawn between these two approaches. And more broadly, that Marxism should take inspiration from techno-science, and that Marxism itself is already an eliminativist project, in that it wants to eliminate kind of cognitive categories such as property and the self as traditionally conceived, and that therefore it shouldn't be in the business of protecting, preserving, resisting, obstructing, but instead embracing and anticipating whole new horizons of human experience and cognition. Okay, what I'm going to concentrate on today are the congruities between three thinkers. The first of these is well known, Louis Althusser. I'm going to look at his work on ideology, which is well known. The second is someone we've already heard about today, Thomas Metzinger. And the third is a less well-known thinker, someone who deserves to be better known, David Smale, who's written on the connections between sort of politics and mental illness or secrets of distress. Okay, I'm going to start off with three sort of lengthy quotations from these thinkers. First, Althusser. In order to grasp what follows, Althusser says, it is essential to realize that both he who is writing these lines and the reader who reads them are themselves subjects, and therefore ideological subjects, a tautological proposition. I.e., that the author and reader of these lines both live spontaneously or naturally in ideology, in the sense in which I have said that man is an ideological animal by nature. that the author, insofar as he writes the line to a discourse which claims to be scientific, is completely absent as a subject from his scientific discourse. For all scientific discourse is by definition a subjectless discourse. There is no subject of science, except in an ideology of science. It's a different question which I shall leave on one side for the moment. As St. Paul eloquently put it, it is in the logos, meaning in ideology, that we live, move, and have our being. It follows that for you and me, the category of the subject is a primary obviousness. Obviousnesses are always primary. It is clear that you and I are subjects, free, ethical, etc. Like all obviousnesses, including those that make a word, name a thing, or have a meaning. Therefore, including the obviousness of the transparency of language, the obviousness that you and I are subjects, and that does not cause any problems, is an ideological effect, the elementary ideological effect. It is indeed a peculiarity of ideology that imposes that appearance to do so, since these are obviousnesses. Obviousnesses as obviousnesses, which we cannot fail to recognise, and before which we have the inevitable and natural reaction of crying out aloud, or in the still small voice of conscience, that's obvious, that's right, that's true. And that quotation is from Althusser's well-known essay, Ideology and Ideological State Apparatuses. Okay, second series of quotes now from Thomas Metzinger's Being Known. We do not experience the reality surrounding us as the contents of a representational process, nor do we represent its components as internal placeholders of another external level of reality. We simply experience it as the world in which we live our lives. That's from page 169. We do not experience the contents of our self-consciousness as the contents of a representational process. We do not experience them as some sort of causally active internal placeholder of the system, in the system's all-inclusive model of reality, but simply as ourselves living in the world right now. On page 331. No such thing as ourselves exists in the world. All that exists are certain information processing systems meeting the constraints for phenomenality, while operating under a transparent self-model. At least for all conscious beings, so far known to us, it is true that they neither have nor are a self. Biological organisms exist, but an organism is not a self. Some organisms possess conscious self-models, but such self-models are certainly not selves. They are only complex brain states. However, if an organism operates under a phenomenally transparent self-model, then it possesses a phenomenal self. The phenomenal property of selfhood as such is a representational construct. Truly, it's a phenomenal property in terms of being an appearance only. For all scientific and philosophical purposes, the notion of a self as a theoretical entity can be safely eliminated. What we have been calling the self in the past is not a substance, an unchangeable essence, or a thing, i.e. an individual in the sense of philosophical metaphysics, but a very special kind of representational content, the content of a phenomenally transparent system model. It is the content of a self model that cannot be recognised as a model by a system using it. A phenomenal experience of substantiality, i.e. being an independent entity that could in principle exist all by itself, of having essence, i.e. being defined by possessing an unchangeable in the most core, invariant set of properties, and of individuality, i.e. being an entity that is unique and cannot be divided, are special forms of conscious representational content as well. That's from page 563. Okay, third set of quotes from David Smale's book, Power, Interest and Psychology, Elements of a Social Materialist Understanding of Distress. What we take to be causal processes of thought, decision and will are frequently little more than a kind of commentary that accompanies our action. As we grow up, we learn to attach words to our activities that, if we're not almost superhumanly attentive, come in our understanding to replace the activities themselves. An awareness that we are pushed and pulled by literally the force of circumstances gives way, if indeed it was ever perceptibly developed, to a conviction that a commentary on these events actually gives rise to them. As Lev Vygotsky argues so powerfully, the child's thought is not somehow internally generated, but is acquired from a social context. Thinking is self-taught, which has become silent. That's from page 39 to 40. What people who suffer psychological distress tend to become aware of, Smell continues, is that no matter how much they want to change, no matter how hard they try, no matter what mental gymnastics they put themselves through, their experiences of life stay much the same. This is because there is no such thing as an autonomous individual. What powers we have are acquired from and distributed within our social context. Some of them the most powerful and unreachable distances from us. The very meaning of our actions is not something we can autonomously determine, but is made intelligible or otherwise by orders of culture, proximal as well as distal, over which we have virtually no control. Okay, and that's from page 46. So what I want to explore here are three congruities amongst the counterintuitive claims made by these very different thinkers. And the fact that their arguments are counterintuitive is, of course, no accident. For it's crucial to what all of them are saying that the intuitive, what seems to come naturally to us, is the very stuff of ideology. And the first congruence I want to draw attention to is this apparently spontaneous operation of ideology. So, one, man is an ideological animal by nature. Now, it could seem as if Metzinger's work is a sustained vindication of Althusser's apparently paradoxical claim that man is an ideological animal by nature. But Metzinger shows that ideology, in the sense of the systematic misrepresentation and misrecognition, is at least as much biological as it is cultural. Ideology isn't just something imposed on a biological organism by culture, rather particular organisms, those that is capable of generating what he calls a phenomenal self-model, are, as it were, spontaneously ideological. The self is a process which misrecognizes itself as a thing. This claim might seem superficially similar to well-known arguments against the self made by the likes of Nietzsche and Hume. Hume and Nietzsche do indeed argue that there is no warrant for substantializing the self, but their thinking does not really have the resources fully to explain how this substantialization occurs, or properly to denounce it as an error. For Hume, the self is an idea that inexplicably appears in the mind, despite having no correlate in the flow of impressions. The nature of the subject is essentially a special effect produced by linguistic conventions. But Nietzsche cannot consistently denounce the subject as illusory, because for him the distinction between truth and appearance is paradoxically the ultimate deception. And this brings us to the second congruity to which I want to draw attention. Two, ideology must be opposed to science. By Althusser, Metzinger's work rests on the ability to make a distinction between science and ideology, between truth and appearance. The self belongs only to the order of appearances. There's nothing but a phenomenal construct, and a phenomenon is by its very nature ideological. One might say that its ideology is such, or pure ideology. For David Smale, to understand distress in terms of interiority, using such concepts as motives, willpower, and indeed the self, is to engage in ideological mystification, in the sense that it obfuscates the real causal processes that act upon so-called individuals. The most important of these processes are what Smale calls distal powers: economics, politics, culture, and ideology. And these are not directly experienceable by the so-called individual. The individual does, however, have experience of the proximal powers which act upon him or her: work, education, social relations, and family. And one of the major problems with most variants of psychotherapy, according to Smale, is that it pays exclusive attention to the distal power, to the proximal powers, focusing especially on social relations and the family. But it cannot properly understand even these if it conceives of them as autonomous causal factors and troubled by the distal powers. As a consequence, Smale argues, traditional psychology has become lost in a magical realm, which in fact has no chance of impacting upon the real world of material space-time. Thus, what we take to be psychology, in this respect, hypostasizes an immaterial world based on linguistic constructions, inevitably giving rise to a mythology of magical voluntarism that is, though highly plausible, deemed to impotence. He continues, the language of willing responsibility, decision, obstinacy, malice and generosity and so on that gives form to our reflections about what people do to us and what to them seem entirely appropriate in the context of normal life, and indeed is taken over barely modified into the theoretical language of therapy. It's hard to resist being misled by the superficial plausibility of this vocabulary. But the dismissal of will responsibility in itself therefore depends upon rejection of the postmodern orthodoxy, which still rules over much of the humanities. This default Nietzscheanism can provingly cite Althusser's theses about ideology, but it deems his appeal to science an embarrassment that is best forgotten about. According to this relativism, science is just another ideology, indeed an ideology of the most pernicious sort. But in entirely dismissing the possibility of a space beyond ideology, the very category of ideology loses any purchase. This is why Smale defends scientific method. Though no doubt intellectually demanding in many respects, he says, scientific method is at its best the least coercive as well as the most accurate way of establishing what is, while acknowledging the limitations of these concepts real and true. End of quote. The return to science does not naturally mean a return to an uncritical positivism. On the contrary, the distinction between ideology and science precisely enables the critique of actually existing institutions and practices. Now, as Smale puts it, what has come to be put forward as scientific and clinical psychology and psychotherapy is a set of dogmas that is shaped and maintained almost exclusively by interest in relation to the ruling discourses of power and aimed at obscuring the causes and consequences of emotional distress. Yet recognizing the self does not exist doesn't mean that we can simply step outside ideology. And here we come to the final congruity I want to point to. Three, we can't step outside ideology at the level of experience. Metzinger and Althusser have both faced similar objections. Why do they continue to refer to themselves by personal pronouns if there is no such thing as a self? But not only is this not an objection to either Metzinger or Althusser's position, their arguments precisely give accounts of why it is not possible to simply set aside the illusion of the self. The solution structures our experience, indeed, it is what has or seems to have our experiences. This is only to say that experience as such is ideological and immune to any correction by scientific understanding. For conscious beings such as us, ideology is built into lived experience, yet our consciousness has also given rise to a perspective that is not circumscribed by the limitations of lived experience. At this point, it's worth noting that for Althusser, mere critique of ideology can only ever be impotent. Science can identify and analyse ideology, but political change can only come via a systemic shift in practices. For Althusser, it must be remembered, ideology doesn't consist in the first instance of ideas in the head. Rather, such ideas, insofar as they are significant, are the effects of practices. Neither you will believe, which is the concept that he takes from Pascal. Ideology, that is to say, is a set of rituals which do not have to be believed in, but merely performed. The political challenge there is not to evade ideology, which, as we have said, is impossible insofar as we are experiencing living subjects, but to invent new rituals to construct distal powers which are capable of subduing and ultimately overcoming the forces which now dominate the world. Okay, leave it there for a minute.
Okay, and now Alexei.
I think it's been a bit of a rough transition.
Yes,
but at least now you have a living voice. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe stealing something from the title of Marx. Maybe I'll rename these comments as a prolegomena to an eliminative dandyism. So I'm going to read a couple of comments, but in many ways these comments were composed in order to frame a reading of a particular figure, Jacques Vaché, who some of you may know, but he was an important precursor of the stature of somebody like Lautremont for the Surrealists. And maybe just since probably not many people know this figure, there's a famous encounter in 1916 between André Breton and Jacques Fauché in a military hospital, and this is where the Surrealist historian, this is how the Surrealist historian Nadeau described the encounter. So it gives you a slight flavor of this character, Fauché, who André Breton rather interestingly described and referred to constantly throughout his work as a figure characterized by desertion from within. And so that the particular form in which we could say Fauché's dandyism manifested itself is in terms of cultivating a ritual of self-desertion. And it's sort of this idea of what I like to call an absentee subject that I find particularly interesting. So here's the quote. "Obliged to remain in bed, Fauché, he entertained himself by drawing and painting a series of postcards for which he invented strange captions. Men's fashions provided almost the only substance that nourished his imagination. He liked those glabrous faces, those hieratic postures to be seen in bars. Every morning he spent a good hour arranging one or two photographs, some saucers, a few violets, on a little lace top table within reach of his hand. Jacques Fauché was a past master in the art of attaching little or no importance to everything. In the streets of Nantes, he strolled sometimes in the uniform of a hussar, an aviator, a doctor. Occasionally, he would pass and not seem to recognize you and go on his way without turning around. Fauché never held out his hand to say hello or goodbye." Okay. And, okay, so then maybe just one other quote from another sort of surrealist that ended up breaking with the group Pierre Navi. "The organization of pessimism is truly one of the strangest watchwords a conscious man can obey." One of the enduring legacies of Marx's analysis of the fetish of commodities is to show that the abstract potency of capital's unrelenting expansion of the logic of exchange produces a natural illusion, a belief in the value of value. The notion of the value of value is sustained by the structural equivocation and contradiction between use and exchange value that acts as the motor of capitalist expansionist logic and the motor of its idealization. It is thus precisely the liquidation of value that becomes the condition of its continued production. So maybe for those of you that are not familiar with this sort of first chapter of Marx's Capital, he maintains that the commodity itself is structured by a distinction between exchange and use value, and that contradiction is both necessary but at the same time irresolvable for the production of value itself. So that, in other words, something insofar as it's a commodity has to be exchangeable, and therefore what is being exchanged has a use value. But insofar as it is being exchanged, the use value has to be negated, since the use attends to material properties which are singular and therefore non-abstractable from the particularity of their use. So there's this structural contradiction where things can only be exchanged insofar as they are attached to things of use, but insofar as they are exchangeable, that very attachment itself has to appear as a negation. Okay, so just a quick primer there. Hopefully that was somewhat helpful. I don't know. So it is thus precisely then the liquidation of value, to repeat myself, that becomes the condition of its continued production. Matter becomes grist for the mill, to quote Walter Benjamin, of the humid back room of spiritualism, which thrives above all on the continual manufacture of optimism, the belief in progress and the ultimate goodness of the human soul. Capital needs its sentimental narratives. So what I'm interested here is in the way in which capital will produces a kind of moral narrative, which is necessary precisely in order to sustain itself. So as Benjamin suggests in his confrontation with surrealism, an emancipatory politics is ill-served by such compromises of sentiment, the coupling of idealistic morality with political practice. He thus argues that the cult of evil, characteristic of the romantic pessimism of the 19th century, from Baudelaire to L'Autrement to Rimbaud, and inherited by surrealism, is a political device to protect thought against moralistic infection. It is thus the cultivation of what I would like to call Luciferian lucidity, with Roger Caillois, that engenders practices, literary, artistic, and theoretical, that can resist, quote, the sclerotic, liberal, moral, humanistic ideal of freedom that still haunts our present. Pessimism and hatred of the existing order becomes the difficult air that the revolutionary must breathe, requisite for coming to grips with the current desolation of experience. Despite the proliferation of humanist readings of Marxism that continue to cast his philosophy of history in a distinctly utopian hue, Marxism, understood generally as the ruthless critique of everything existing, is more adequately engendered within dystopian figures, in subjects whose lucidity with respect to their time stems from their detachment from a profound disgust with life, a certain misanthropy, and even perhaps a cold and cynical indifference. The revolutionary has much to learn from the anarchic discipline of the Luciferian spirit. Roger Caillois locates the birth of this attitude or tendency in the 19th century in the wake of the French Revolution. Caillois argues that this Luciferian strain of pessimism is engendered by the melancholia infecting the defenders of his rebellious precursor, Satan. So he makes this distinction between Satan and Lucifer. Satanic pessimism has its basis in the destruction of the artist's place within the social structure. With the corrosion of the system that secured for the artist a secure social basis and means of subsistence, the artist takes on an autonomous social status, becoming a free thinker, a prototype of the intellectual, and a new breed of rebellious subjectivity is born. Lacking an appointed position within the social order, and viewing himself evermore as exile, as a misunderstood outsider, the artist writer assumes the role of critic of that social order and feels with a certain acuteness the instability of the human's place in the world. Attuned to the ways in which the subject is in turn subjected to domination within the subject order, he marshals his critique around the defense of the essential autonomy of the individual. As such, Satanism is a bourgeois disorder engendered by the unforeseen, unacceptable, and disheartening obstacles that followed in the wake of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, and the failure of this revolution to truly secure for the individual the autonomy and freedom he was promised. Satanism, Caillois writes, was an authentic collective force searching for an image that could condense and valorize these acute and commonly shared aspirations, an image that would be a sign, incitement, and example. As the celestial projection of man's demands, satanic mythology, the angel of evil, appears, quote, as instinctive and courageous, but heedless, revolt against the existence of evil and established powers. So, however, driven primarily by sentiment and moral impulse, Satanism risks becoming a compensatory image, a melancholic projection which compensates for the lack of individual freedom. Caillois writes, his followers seem to assert the rights of the individual without being able to do more than despair of ever existing, of ever exercising them. Their disdain poorly masks their impotence, disorientation, and lack of practical sense. The Luciferian corrective, then, to this bourgeois disorder, this satanic rebellion, is Machiavellian. Accepting that force is the law of the world and abandoning the romantic notion of revolt for revolt's sake, Lucifer, in contrast to Satan's impassioned irrationalism, is cool and cunning, disdainful, contemptuous, and severe. His taste for transgression is constrained by self-discipline. Having enough faith in his rebellion, Caillois writes, to view it as a future order, he does not tolerate any indiscipline from any source that might undermine it. Driven by a thirst for lucidity, not sentiment, the Luciferian strips the satanic of its melancholia, right, of this sort of this desire to recover something that it was deprived of. Lucifer is entirely focused on what is possible and undertakes it without delay. The Luciferian, then, is not an attack on the individualistically oriented, is not an attack on individualistically oriented revolt. an attack on disorganized pessimism. Sorry, the Luciferian then is not only an attack on such revolt, right, on individualistically oriented revolt. It is also an attack on the way in which Satan is an image that seeks to valorize its current subjection. So if Luciferian lucidity is essentially turned back on itself, the principle of his authority, as Caillois writes, is a severity applied only to himself. It is because it seeks only negation and not its own valorization. And it does so through attacking it at its core, the belief in belief. The Luciferian attempts to divest the living of its belief in life. Satanism's escape into the humid back room of spiritualism, like all such escapes, is in search of a sign, some hidden order that could restore man's place in the world. It is an attempt to reorient itself in the world through finding a reason to believe. To be done with belief, however, could be the revolutionary nihilist slogan animating the anti-utopian strain of Marxism. Action that is not undertaken for the sake of a better future, but out of disgust with life and the moronic iniquity of human, all too human folly. It does not locate its revolutionary impetus in hope or faith, but despair. As Pierre Navi writes, a certain despair is the lot of serious, unwearied minds severely applied to their object, almost always to themselves in every age. We are talking of the human, that is, all in all, of the living sense of desertion and perdition. Pessimism is at the source of Hegel's philosophy, and it is also at the source of Marx's revolutionary method. But what does it mean to be in search of a form of action that refuses belief? Is this not a fatal recipe? Yeah. What I read up to this moment. Okay. Do you want to answer that? Why don't I finish up the comments and then I can sort of explain it again, you know, off the cuff, so to speak, after I finish. Okay. And then everything will be Luciferianly lucid. Okay. Which is rather dark, so I don't promise anything. The Luciferian correct... So the fatal recipe. So one of the key virtues of Marx's critique of fetishism lies in showing that belief is the essential way in which the subject is inscribed into the social field. Okay, so... And that this belief, then, is not only a function of what one knows, but what one does. So in this sense, in other words, what Marx calls the fetishism of the commodity is something that's structurally embedded in the commodity that affects how one thinks about it, but how one thinks about it is indissociable from one's practice. The fact that even though we might know that there's a distinction between use and exchange, if we want anything that's useful to us, right, we need to engage in exchange to acquire it. So this practice itself, which is absolutely necessary under current social conditions, in other words, under a capitalist mode of production, spontaneously produces a belief in value. And what I'm claiming, a belief in the value of value. So this Luciferian corrective, I'm claiming, is a kind of self-discipline that seeks to undermine and attack this fundamental belief, which is the belief in belief itself, which I think is the very structural form under which capital then reproduces itself as a social system. So pessimism then, understood as a political device, is a kind of exegesis, a kind of self-practice of this on the self, in which one steels oneself against the beliefs that they're engendered, perhaps irreparably, by what one does. As Marx stresses, the fetishistic quality of commodities does not fall on the side of the subject as an error in cognition. It pertains to the very structure of the commodity itself. The commodity resuscitates, through its contradictory structure, the belief that objects have value outside their social relation. And yet, the theoretical apprehension of this structure does little to hamper its effect. Capital accomplishes the subject's social inscription in and through the commodity's structural mystification of this very inscription. So that, in other words, it seems perfectly natural that the value of things can be given in terms of price, for example. In other words, the social system has this character of transparency. It seems perfectly natural that it is this way, right? And this naturalness is an effect produced by this, by the continued circulation practice of exchanging commodities. And the particular sort of problem, I think, and maybe what links what would seem to be a very, very different discourse to, let's say, the conversation that Ray and Thomas had earlier, might be this question of what does it mean when, in fact, a form of cognition, so a kind of knowledge that one has about a practice, has little effect or capacity to interrupt that very practice. So the very fact that you know that a commodity is in fact nothing but something that exchanged for social purposes, right, does not strip the commodity of its fetish quality. So that, in other words, mere knowledge of this structure does not demystify it. And this is a real problem. In other words, if in fact, on the one hand, the belief in reason as a demystifying force, in fact, kind of reaches a certain kind of limit, what does one do then at that point? So even if capital does indeed liquidate the various qualitative figures of the bond, so this is from the Communist Manifesto, the family, nation, religion. So the claim here is, again, for those of you who haven't read this, is that, in other words, all previous forms of social value, so the state, let's say, or the family, or also religious forms of valuation, can be recoded in terms of the abstractions of capital. So that, in other words, on the one hand, Marx will want to claim that this then therefore liquidates their value. So they no longer actually have the same kind of social purchase, the capacity to ground, let's say, a society through their value form. Because the society, in order to reproduce itself, has to be grounded in relationship to value, the value form, namely capital. But at the same time, so it replaces them, as Marx says, with the vagaries of callous cash payment. It engenders, nonetheless, the purest form of belief. This is my claim, the belief in belief itself. So that what capital does is it sort of liquidates all particular contents of belief, but it replaces that with the form of belief in belief itself, which is that of capital. So capital as an empty content can therefore become utterly parasitic in all forms of value. And therefore, it's also a reason why capital, although it liquidates value, it nonetheless allows for the repetition and recurrence of all past values. So of course, you know, even if we could say the family is liquidated of value, nonetheless, you know, conservatives are constantly harping on the necessity of a return to family. So that now, these values are empty structurally as far as their social content is concerned because they're not necessary for the reproduction of the sort of base elements, let's say, of the society, namely capital. But nonetheless, they are necessary in order to constantly regenerate forms of belief in belief itself, right? So that they also serve the purposes of engendering capital. Okay. So the subject's relation then to other subjects and thus to itself is inscribed in its very practice, In other words, in it's constantly reenacting the contradiction between use and exchange value. The subject believes in value and the value of value. And so maybe just as an addendum now, this is where just kind of returning to my initial comments about the absentee subject and why I think this is important is that I think it's an important supplement to Kaihua's rather elusive treatment of what he calls Luciferian lucidity. So the search for the autonomous subject becomes a necessary ideological supplement to the programmatic elements of a social system whose systematicity grows in equal proportion to the outbursts of irrationality within the system. So what I mean, that statement there is basically that, in other words, capital itself, the very coherence of capital depends upon the structural contradictions that allow it to constantly resolve the various crises that appear within the system itself. So that capital's very systematicity doesn't exclude the crises that drive it, but in fact constantly reproduces them, reproduces those very crises. And so, and the claim then that Walter Benjamin was making is that forms of moralism underpinned by the notion of the autonomous self. And this probably maybe comes in, deals with some of what Mark was dealing with. That this, the notion of bourgeois morality is completely necessary in order to engender subjects that constantly will maintain and regenerate this belief in belief itself. Right. And there's actually a very interesting fragment that's by Benjamin on the religious structure of capital that I think is very interesting here. So he wants to claim that capitalism is structured like a religion, not by any of its contents, by its very form itself. Okay. So why then this idea of an absentee subject? And I think this is why if I sort of rather comically sort of maybe use this notion of polygamina, which alludes to Kant's philosophy, I think why Kant remains an interesting figure in this is not because he is the one who provides, let's say, the most rigorous account of the bourgeois subject in the Critique of Practical Reason, but it's more for the insights in this book, the Critique of Pure Reason, where consciousness discovers that the sense of the world which it inhabits is determined by mechanisms over which it has no control, but which it nonetheless serves to ground, right? So this is an interesting way in which we could maybe sort of deal with this problem of why it is that the subject can't identify with its brain, right? That the subject and what it is that this knowledge adds, that the subject can discover, in fact, that there are mechanisms that produce the phenomenal world over which it has little control, but nonetheless serve to ground that very experience. And so here then, Kant's Critique of Pure Reason is of historical import, since it registers the fact that the self is nothing but a constant impersonation, in the sense that it is impersonal and unsubstantial, a necessary mask that must be adorned lest meaning vanish. Maybe we can maybe pick up on this, since that comment might not be immediately intelligible. And it is in this context that a new form of subjective comportment or attitude is engendered that Kaihua referred to as Luciferian, in which self-dissolution as non-conformist experimentation becomes a search for forms of indetermination or indetermining the self. Okay, so maybe I'll end on that note.
Okay, thanks, Alexei. There's a lot. Maybe what I'll try to do is maybe just kind of recapitulate, or try to kind of, you know, the points of connection between your talk and Mark's, and this the issues that were raised in the discussion with Thomas. So first of all, this there's a couple of like terms, distinctions that seem to be operative. And first of all, distinction between subjectivity and selfhood. In the Althusser quotes that Mark used, Althusser is talking about the subject, but it's clear that what he means by when Althusser describes kind of subjectivity as inherently ideological, he's talking about what would otherwise be described as phenomenal selfhood. In other words, the subject as an individuated locus of experience. Then the distinction between science and ideology, the point being that Marxist science, historical materialism, is precisely the discourse which exposes the social mechanisms that constitute selves, basically, that force you to always recognize yourself as a person with this set of interests, etc., etc. So it seems to me that the point of contact between the between Thomas's kind of discourse and this kind of classical Marxist discourse is between what Thomas is describing and kind of excavating in his work are the subpersonal mechanisms that generate subjective experience. Whereas the Marxist tradition identifies the suprapersonal mechanisms, in other words, the social mechanisms, okay, that obviously are, cognitively impenetrable to the individual self, actually, for the same reason as they are cognitively impenetrable, as the subpersonal mechanisms are cognitively impenetrable, because, as you put it, they are transparent. So the commodity form is transparent. The mechanisms that force you to, through which you believe in commodities and you are bewitched by the power of the of commodities, is something that is in apparence, or that is at least invisible at the level of your immediate experience. So one plausible connection is it possible to kind of is the notion of transparency and the distinction between transparency and opacity. In other words, representations which are invisible as representations and representations which are exposed as representations is operative at both levels, and both at the subpersonal and suprapersonal level. And then the question, and it seems to me that both Mark and you were trying to kind of Mark was explicitly trying to kind of identify the conjunction between those two kind of senses of transparency. And in your talk, now you said something. Well, I'm going to ask you to maybe kind of just elaborate on something you said. You said that the reason why, even if we, there seems to be an issue about, like, even when we understand how things are generated or produced, even when we understand how a trick or an illusion is performed, nevertheless, we still experience it as a trick. When you've had a conjuring trick explained to you, nevertheless, you still see the phenomenon. You still see the rabbit, what looks like a rabbit coming out of a hat. So cognitive impenetrability is a function of transparency. Okay, because you look through the representation, you are all you need to do to dupe a subject is simply to dissimulate the representational status of a mechanism. And to convince them to believe that an appearance is to take appearances at face value. Now, you said that at a social level, it's actions. In other words, that the reason why people kind of continue to believe in belief, or the reason why they will still invest while they're still kind of, lured or kind of seduced by commodities is because of a system of practices. So that even if they know and understand lots of things about the world, nevertheless they cannot help but experience the world in this way. So can you say more about, first of all, what is the status of these practices, these social practices? And in other words, if the understanding, demystification can't ever simply be kind of unfolded at the level of cognition. So demystification, simply understanding how an illusion is produced, is insufficient. You need to kind of change people's relationship to it by changing the set of practices through which they engage with the world. Is that correct? Is that what you were trying to kind of to get at?
Yeah, Mark was I think referred to this passage in Althusser where he talks about the function of ritual.
Yes.
So the idea is Althusser's point is the claim that in other words, it's not that one believes and therefore one engages in rituals because one believes, but it's the very practices of rituals, like the act of kneeling, etc., the various rituals that produce the form of belief itself. So that in this sense, then, like when the subject is hailed or interpolated, treats itself as a subject, it does so because it uses language. So that, in other words, that it through the practice of speaking, one is immediately interpolated and identifies oneself as a subject, because one is already related to a social field that then is structured by language. So that, in other words, likewise, Marx's account is sort of one that's saying that as soon as one is related to the social field, one is only related to the social field in a capitalist mode of production through engaging in exchange. But what is being exchanged are various things of use. So that, in other words, one's belief in the value form of capital is constantly being produced by what is necessary for one to meet one's material needs within the capitalist society. Now the question is why this is, and why the problem that this is, or why Marx provides such a radical challenge, let's say, to the tradition of philosophy, is this sort of this Platonic model that liberation comes through self-knowledge. Mm-hmm. Right? This is precisely the philosophical value that Marx, but not just Marx, is putting into question. So that, in other words, it's one's ability, let's say, to exit the cave is not going to be a matter of a cognitive recognition that appearances qua are in fact appearances. Right? This in fact, in other words, the cognitive apprehension that an appearance is merely an appearance. Or to use your example that a magical trick is merely a trick, doesn't mystify it. Mm. Doesn't demystify it. So in other words, we constantly still go to, I don't necessarily, but one still goes to magic shows, right? Even though one knows that in fact, the woman is not hovering above the table, right? So this is, I think, something very similar to what Marx is talking about, but the fetish quality of the commodity, or we could say the function of religion within contemporary society. In other words, why it is that it's not only, we could say in pre-scientific or societies that religion has such a grip, but precisely within enlightened societies as well, is that, in other words, there's a way in which the very structures, the practices one engage in, produces a form of belief that is necessary socially. Mm-hmm. So then the question, I think, why the introduction of Kaiwa is because they're at the same time, in other words, what Kaiwa is interested in is trying to trace a genealogy of something that is not by any means a transhistorical phenomena, mm-hmm. but a certain form of subjective disposition that emerges in the 19th century that is not only critical of society, but engages in a form of a kind of self-attack, what somebody might call rituals of dissolution. Mm-hmm. So films of actions of self-destruction, cultural forms in which sense itself is immediately being assaulted or under attack. And how is it that one can account culturally for the emergence of such phenomena? I think this is why something like Luciferian lucidity becomes interesting, precisely because it says that the critique of capital is not merely a matter of cognition, but has to engage in a set of practices, and these practices that I was trying to sort of frame concern themselves with an assault on the form of the self as subject.
Okay.
So, but it precisely doesn't pass through any sort of cognitive register, right? So various forms of, you know, cultural phenomena could be read or reinterpreted within this light, from Dada and Surrealism, which is obviously the more of the context, but up through forms of kind of punk, etc. Yeah.
So can you explain, if this lucidity is not, it's not cognitive, it's not just, how is it, what is it, how does it work, basically? And what kind of information or understanding or whatever, I don't know what term you want to use, would lead, you know, an otherwise normal individual, an individual who's been kind of socialized exactly the same way as, you know, the vast majority of his fellows. What distinctions, because obviously the term dandyism is, mm-hmm. I mean, the paradox is that there's this kind of hyper-individualism, which is based on kind of the destruction of, you know, of the tokens of individuality as described in terms of, as fetishized by the commodity form. And in other words, individuals who refuse to invest in themselves, who refuse to believe in themselves, because capitalism, this is one of the things I think you were suggesting, is that we are constantly, you have to invest in yourself. And self-improvement is the contemporary kind of mantra. And I think one of the things you seem to be suggesting is that this labor, this ascesis, whereby you can stop believing in yourself and stop investing in yourself, requires this kind of distance, which kind of splits the subject from the self. In other words, there seems to be a kind of subjectivation, which isn't immediately kind of woven up with the commodification of a self. But the question is still how. Are there resources in art, for instance? I mean, you seem to be suggesting that there's something about, you know, kind of artistic, about kind of artistic practice or artistic engagement, which provides a kind of a really indispensable resource to carry out this work. Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, I mean, absolutely. I don't know if I would want to restrict it merely to, let's say, to artistic practice. Let's say, I mean, I think. There would be, you know, forms of theoretical practice too. I mean, that would be that would also be seen as being as essential, let's say, to this work of undoing the self. So I mean, so the real question is that, I mean, what would it mean to live without belief? Mm-hmm. I mean, what does it mean to radically detach oneself from the concept of value? I don't think this is actually an end that's achievable. The question is that can one do? How does one do harm to the value of value, right? Because one does not simply subtract oneself constantly from the practices that are necessarily going to regenerate that very belief, right? So that, in other words, why is it that surrealism, for example, became incredibly obsessed with suicide? Mm. Not necessarily as a practice either to be carried out. Even though various figures did, Jacques Fauché being one of them, but Jacques Rigaud, other figures too, I mean, naturally, maybe committed suicide. But what does it mean as a figure of thought to take up the question of suicide? In other words, what as an attitude, for example, why is it interesting to adopt the attitude of pessimism? I mean, this is more the set of questions that I'm posing. In other words, what effect does attitude have on changing how one relates to oneself to the social field, and therefore how one relates to believing in the reality of not only the value of objects in that field, but also the value that one puts in oneself, right? That the self has value, right? Or even for that matter, the fact that, you know, capital doesn't only say that, in fact, as a self you have value, it also constantly devalues the self, right? So there are very sort of various mechanisms that are constantly being placed in the workplace to evaluate, right, the worker's performance, right, is to, in other words, it's constantly being evaluated, reevaluated, and oftentimes, right, you're seen as being deficient. So, I mean, being treated as waste, as something that's irrelevant, I mean, this is as much a part of the very structure of value as being only treated as a good thing. Mm. So then the question is then, I mean, how is it that one does, how is it that one attacks this problematic complex of belief in value, if in fact, then theoretical cognition of the structure that produces belief doesn't seem to hamper its effect? So the issue then would be to take up this problem of the way in which practice itself embeds forms of intelligence, which I think Althusser is claiming in terms of the way in which ritual in some sense precedes meaning and produces rather the very object of belief rather than actually proceeding from it, but could also be, I mean, I don't know, I mean, it was making me think something that Thomas was saying earlier about the way in which the perceptual field already embeds forms of incredibly complex intelligence, right? So that, in other words, our practices already contain intelligence that are enacted or are spontaneously performed. It's precisely in that sense that it's those practices that ground meaning. And so the question is on the one hand, theoretically, one can expose that the grounds of the meaning of those things are in fact without grounds. But then meaning remains. So that, in other words, even in our conversation, I mean, this is a very sort of starting point of philosophical discourse, right? That one has to agree to minimal conditions, namely that we are both operating under the shared presupposition of the logos, right? Of speech that is governed by a minimal form of consistency. Right? If I simply don't agree to those terms, then the dialogue itself utterly disintegrates. Right? And the question here is that we're dealing with forms of practice that are engaging in attacks on sense that are operating outside of the conditions of accepting the terms of a kind of rational dialogue.
Okay, just one final remark, then I think we should open this up. But yeah, these practices, most, like the example that Thomas gave, like, you know, catching a moving ball, this is a completely, the complexity of information processing. In other words, I think it's, you have to be careful about identifying intelligence with kind of information processing and degrees of complex information processing, because that is still simply kind of utilitarian, okay? So they're just because they're fantastically complex, you know, mechanisms of processing that our bodies are continuously engaged in, and these kind of, you know, kind of autonomic practices subtend conceptual understanding, they are still completely constrained by adaptation. They're utilitarian. Mm-hmm. They do things for a reason, and it's an adaptive reason, and it's natural selection. Social practices can also, now, the question is, at the level of social practice, what are the, is there a way of dissociating kind of the intelligence of social practice from any kind of crass utilitarianism? In other words, so that it's not just about, so for instance, a cynic would say these forms of dandyism and kind of Dada-esque self-destruction, yeah, it's just kind of, you can give a reductive sociological explanation in terms of trying to be interesting, being a narcissist, et cetera, et cetera. Now that would be the kind of the, you know, the brutally kind of reductive utilitarian
explanation. Which it is all those things.
Yeah.
At the same time.
So, yeah. But is it more than that? Is there something?
Well, I mean, I think the, I mean, I think the more lies not in it, in its sort of in the shock effects. Mm. So I think like obviously referring to sort of the classical avant-garde ends up being highly problematic precisely because the social conditions today are so radically different than necessarily the ones that engendered those practices, so that the shock effects, let's say, of such of those practices, it's not interesting to, let's say, to judge those on in terms of the effects that they produced within the culture. So it ends up being in I think this is why this form of ascesis becomes interesting, because it's less about the social effects that are caused, but rather around producing a form of subjectivity that detaches itself from its belief in the subject. So it's not by any means obviously trying to say that this kind of dandyism becomes a substitute for the revolutionary subject. I mean, that would be obviously, a comical or a grotesque sort of claim, which maybe might be interesting for those reasons, but not really. I think it becomes much more about a supplement to a form of practice, especially in the times of a kind of like wanton decadence. Mm. You know, where in fact, like you have, where so much sort of, let's say, so much, I mean, it becomes self-reflexive about the way in which so much theoretical Marxism is empty posturing, but it doesn't own the posture. And so the question is then what is added to the fact when the practice of posturing itself becomes structurally integral to the activity? Right? This is I think why it becomes somewhat interesting. But on the other hand, is it narcissistic? Well, yes, in a certain respect. Right? I mean but at the same time it's a form of narcissism that is trying to do damage to the very basis of narcissism itself, which would be, right, the belief in the self. So okay. It's trying to deflate a belief in the self, but it's obviously engaged to a certain extent on an individualist as an individual practice. The other sort of thing that you mentioned, I think, yeah, was probably just a reckless an attempt to sort of draw an analogy between two very different things. In other words, this idea of appealing maybe to forms of adaptive intelligence versus sort of the practices that take place on a symbolic level. Mm. So that we're dealing with things that are only made possible once one enters the symbolic level. So the apprehension of language, etc. I should be a lot more careful, even though, I mean, I haven't been probably about making those sorts of connections.
Okay, I think we should let people interject and intervene.
Thanks. Interesting. I have a very, very simple question. What do you mean by belief? I may believe in Santa Claus, and I may believe in Marx, but I'm not using belief in the same sense in those two instances. And it seems to me, throughout what you're saying, you're slipping from one sense of belief to another sense of belief. And just simple question, what do you mean by belief?
What do I mean by belief?
One sense of belief seems to do with value, and the other sense of belief seems to be do with endorsing the existence of something. So belief as in agreeing on the value of something, and belief in the sense of, I think this thing exists. And you're using belief in two senses unclear way.
No, I mean, I think maybe the what's interesting about Marx's analysis of the fetish is the very fact that there is a structural equivocation between precisely those two things. So between the existential claim and, let's say, what was the other term that you were using? It doesn't have to believe in the actual existence of the thing to believe in the existence of the thing, right? That's the paradoxical structure of the commodity. So that, in other words, you can be aware of the fact that it doesn't exist, right? Which you obviously know, I mean, because the prices of something can shift. So you know that, in fact, there's nothing intrinsic about the value of the thing that you are purchasing. But nonetheless, one has to make believe, so to speak, and therefore, through making believe, one truly does believe, because that, in fact, act of making believe produces the very social environment in which one is living. So that, I mean, I think that that level of equivocation in value is precisely what's necessary and maybe is what why I was saying that capital ends up becoming structural belief, so belief in belief itself, which is an empty form of belief. Precisely because any content can be placed into the empty placeholder because what one all one believes in is the form itself. So that the I think the equivocation that you're or the sense that you're pointing to is this very difference between the form and content of belief, which is precisely the equivocation that is constantly being mobilized within capital, at least according to Marx. I don't know if that addresses what you're saying.
Hi. It seems like the one of the things that you're dealing with here is the question of how you would find points to pin this the sort of super-personal description or a super-personal demystification of this kind of transparency to a sub-personal demystification without resorting to just an analogy or metaphor. And I'm wondering whether, because there seems to be an analogical connection between ideology in Althusser's sense and in particular inculcation and synaptic plasticity in the brain, as Catherine Malibu has talked about, and I'm wondering whether you have a reading of that that might help to kind of illuminate this.
It seemed like it was addressed
okay,
to you.
Just so I'm clear about the, so you, is there, what is the connection or the link between Althusser's, the ideological interpolation or the role or the function of ideology in Althusser and, or between suprapersonal kind of mystification or things that are cognitively impenetrable at the suprapersonal level, which is ideology, and things that are cognitively impenetrable at the subpersonal level because they're just neurobiological mechanisms.
I'm wondering specifically is whether the idea of plasticity in the brain, so the way that the brain responds to kind of repeated stimulus and develops in accordance with that, might be, because that seems to be analogically connected to the idea that of reproduction in ideology, especially through physical inculcation.
Yes, and I think, you know, this is why I think it would be kind of foolish to hold up kind of, neuroplasticity or the kind of the brain's, the incredible kind of metamorphic plasticity. You have the level of neural functioning, how the brain can reallocate functions when, when it's damaged, with some kind of potential for refashioning or resistance to these suprapersonal mechanisms. I mean, it's kind of plasticity, I think, is no bulwark against kind of ideological kind of coercion, domination. And obviously, like, it's precisely kind of contemporary capitalism that exploits kind of this plasticity by mobilizing a whole set of kind of technological mechanisms that, as Thomas was pointing out, capture our attention, are restructuring your attention, okay? This is obviously, so this is, where kind of, neuroplasticity is being exploited by kind of, a capitalist system. And it seems that unless, so the question is, okay, so plasticity on its own is kind of neutral, okay? So the question is, what can you, I personally don't think that you can, the question is, can you find an alternative set of mechanisms that would kind of counteract this kind of the restructuring of attention and of subjective experience that capitalism is kind of actively engaged in promoting. But simply saying, holding up plasticity as a kind of, as an objection to kind of neurological reductionism is, I think, a very weak gesture, okay? I think what's, unless you kind of, the rhetoric of plasticity, adaptation, flexibility is obviously ideologically overcoded as well. So I think the war has to be waged on the two fronts at once, kind of the subpersonal and superpersonal. And you have to understand the kind of the individual nervous system as the interface between these two dimensions. And this is where you have to find some way of connecting these two critiques of representation, the critique of phenomenal transparency in the phrenological domain, and the critique of ideological transparency in the kind of the social domain. That's a very tall order. I mean, so I don't know if that's kind of helpful, and then Pete afterwards, and.
Hi, sorry. I don't know if this leads on from that a little bit, linking what Thomas was saying. I want to bring in I was really interested in the idea of the nihilist or the pessimist as pessimism being a motivational force for revolution or for trying to undermine the system which you find yourself in, and how that relates to the idea of procreation, which Thomas hinted at earlier. And I like this, and in relation to evolution as well, this idea that if the people who have this awakening and become the pessimists who attempt to undermine the system are also the ones that do not procreate, then are we kind of doomed in this sort of evolution that we're going to have to continually relearn this nihilism or this pessimism that's going to motivate us to try to overthrow the system?
Let me try and kind of understand. So you're saying that a pessimism which, like, if you're so pessimistic and if you're so kind of hostile to actually existing reality that you withdraw to the point of, like, you know, refusing to reproduce. This is not a useful.
Is there such a thing as a sustainable value?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe.
The answer to that is no.
Okay. Why not?
Why is it unsustainable?
Yes.
Well, I mean, because dandyism, I mean, doesn't really exist.
Okay.
Is part of the problem. I mean, it's sort of. I mean, it's a sort of 19th century sort of problem. So that in other words, if there's a sort of contemporary dandyism, it's sort of a spectral nature. But I mean, I think that's why, I mean, of course, I think it's interesting, let's say, as a tactical assault, let's say, on a particular, like, context or conjuncture to mobilize, let's say, pessimism. I don't know, it's not necessarily, it can never be turned into a transcendental, right? I mean, I think that, I mean, that would be, I mean, comical probably as a gesture to try to universalize pessimism as an individual affect. I mean, I think that it's always going to be the particular character of a singular situation in which then pessimism, as Naveed would say, must be organized. So it's always, I mean, I think that, I mean, what's interesting about it is that to a certain extent, one of the underpinnings of this is beginning to try to think theoretically about the status of an attitude and what does the notion of theoretical attitude mean, right? I mean, because it's this level of affect that attaches itself to a theory that is nonetheless a purely subjective affect. Mm-hmm. And that, but its force lies in precisely being a subjective affect. So it's not something that can be, I mean, I don't think it's something that could be universalized.
But couldn't it be propagated, though? And hasn't it been successfully propagated? In other words, there might be other, I mean, I think this might be what you're asking, is that can this be, obviously reproduction, biological reproduction is not the only mode of cultural transmission. And if you can transmit attitudes, and presumably this is what, you know, kind of artists would do, and that would be a way of kind of successfully, I mean, if not a sustainable dandyism, a kind of, you know, an infectious dandyism, okay? Something that would contaminate other otherwise healthy kind of subjects. Pete, yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay, sorry.
All right, I'll do my best to be as brief as possible. I think an alternative title for your paper might be Zen and the Art of Marxist Critique, insofar as precisely what you're advocating is the issue that runs through Thomas and Mark is how do we get beyond ideology, or how do we produce good ideology, or this is the issue, and your responses to some extent don't think do.
Pardon me, sorry.
Don't think, do, which is a very kind of Zen idea.
No, but that's not at all the case.
But I think.
Yeah. That would be not a position that I would at all endorse. Nor do I think that would be the effect of the position of the paper.
Well, anyway, I think there's an alternative, and I think that, again, there's an interesting tie between Mark and Thomas's idea. Thomas mentioned non-cognitivism, and he mentioned this issue that. Look, he has normative beliefs, but he doesn't think normative beliefs have truth values. And so the question was, well, how do we continue to have normative beliefs when we recognise that there's no scientific status for them? And Mark raised the same issue at the end of his paper. It was, well, once we recognise that what ideology is, how do we continue to make ideology in a way which is productive and effective? And another term which turns up in the non-cognitivist debate, which I think is very helpful here, is fiction. Right, once we recognise that selves are fictions, right, how do we continue to create and live with those fictions? And there's two other terms here that you can use to think about the transition. One is myth, right? Once we recognise that the self is a myth, a false fiction, how do we move to producing and continuing to create fictions in a way which is honest and not just self-deceptive? And the other term here, which is what myth ultimately becomes in a self-conscious way, is art. Right? Once we recognize that the ways of producing selves that we have are not necessary, they're not handed down to us by God, but are things of our own creation, right? We can actually start to think about, wait a minute, how do we want to create them? And that's a self-conscious, artistic approach to the creation of subjectivity and forms of practice, which seems to be anathema to your rejection of self-consciousness.
I think we should stop, Alex. Then we still have time for Evans. Okay. Or Evans, do you want to ask your question now? And maybe, Alex, can you answer?
I'll just say this very quickly, and I think it's a debate that will get picked up in conversations after, but the missing term in all of this is collective abolition itself. I think this is the key thing raised in there. I mean, for example, the problem with even the Luciferian lucidity position is it's still the act of self that chooses to undergo this thing. So I think the thing worth stressing in all of these is that, you know, the exact question of what's the link between the subpersonal and the superpersonal, if it's indexed to the individual, well, it's to say it'll only be kind of mass processes of the reckoning of the individual subject. There's no way, either because, you know, why can't you exit the cave? Why can't you just sort of decide that, a watch is worth nothing and you take it free? Because cops shoot you when you try to leave the cave. They're material remainders. So the only way you abolish the self cannot be, you know, there's a prepping of the ground, a pessimistic grounding attitude, I agree, a fundamental stance. But the only way these are materially enacted are mass collective processes of a destruction of the self, and that
the question is that in the particular moment, within a particular conjuncture,
yes,
when you don't actually have, I mean, this sort of collective index.
No, I agree.
Right? I mean, this is the problem, right? Rather than just constantly maintaining a kind of a projection of the to come, when this collective will manifest itself.
Yeah, right?
Okay, I'm so sorry. We have to finish. We have to end here. So, thanks again. Thanks for coming.